Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hurricane Katrina was on George W. Bush's mind yesterday, but the president's deeper issue appeared to be flagging American support for the war in Iraq. In a major speech, he lashed that war more tightly than ever to the legacy of World War II. This hour, On Point, we listen to the president and test his framing. But first, we look to New Orleans, where residents and emergency teams are still struggling with the unfolding devastation of Hurricane Katrina. Floodwaters broke through at least two levees on Tuesday, submerging New Orleans in up to 20 feet of water and leaving the city of nearly 500,000 people largely uninhabitable. Penny Brown Roberts is a reporter for the Baton Rouge Advocate. We caught up with her as she was driving back to New Orleans for more reporting today. I asked her to describe what she had seen.
Yesterday, we were in St. Bernard Parish, which is just east of New Orleans. It's one of the hardest hit areas down there. There is water throughout the entire parish up to the roof lines. We went out on a boat in the evening with the captain of Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries yesterday, early in the morning before dawn, and there were people shouting from rooftops and attics begging to be rescued. Yesterday after dawn, they had a long line, about a mile long, of people with boats going into the water. They were using the end of a bridge, the St. Claude Bridge that goes into St. Bernard Parish from New Orleans. They were using that as a boat launch, essentially, because there's so much water there, and just putting people in boats, bringing them to the bridge, and dropping them off.
Penny, how would you describe the mindset of the people you're seeing there? We hear reports of looting around New Orleans and elsewhere. The governor of Louisiana, Kathleen Blanco's, called for a day of prayer to calm everyone down. Is there panic? Are people stunned?
There's very much panic. The people who were being rescued yesterday were begging for food and water as they were walking across the bridge, just begging for it. I also drove through parts of New Orleans trying to get a phone signal, and people were pounding on my van, demanding that the National Guard get in there and do things. I went past a produce company, and they had spray-painted on the side of their building, "Looters will be shot, loot and die," things like that. They had posted guards outside the building.
We're reading these signs, "You loot, I shoot." The mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, says 80% of the city is below water. Are people looking to be rescued there and rebuild there, or do they just want to get out?
I think at this point they just want to get out. We have reports this morning that water is coming through the levee and flooding parts of Uptown, which is another part of New Orleans that was not previously flooded. So we're going to have to deal with another emergency situation this morning.
We know you're driving back toward New Orleans as we speak. What's the presence there of National Guard, of police? Are the rescue forces in evidence, or are people just waiting?
There are signs of it, but within the city of New Orleans itself is like a ghost town. There are a few police units parked in front of businesses and things like that, but I think they are in the hot spots at this point trying to rescue people where people are stranded. So other parts of the city are complete ghost towns. We drove past a Walmart yesterday, and people had truckloads of shoes and food and everything else that they had taken. That's the Walmart off Chapatula Street in an area that was not flooded. So, you know, there was not a lot of police presence over there because they're all focused on the hot spots.
You were back in Baton Rouge overnight. I guess you had to go back to follow your story. Cell phone coverage is out. How are people around Louisiana processing this? Are they looking at this as a vast calamity, as another manageable storm in a place that's seen storms before? How are they taking it on board?
We talked to some law enforcement yesterday who didn't even have, they could not even communicate among themselves because their radios were not working. The New Orleans Fire Department was talking about their frustration because they can't even communicate with one another and find out what's going on. So I think at this point it's very much just people are flying by the seat of their pants. They're rescuing people when they see them. But it's difficult to get some organization because they can't even communicate at this point.
Hard to know when anything like normalcy will return there. Penny Brown Roberts on the road to New Orleans. Good luck to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Penny Brown Roberts is a reporter for the Baton Rouge Advocate. She spoke with us from the outskirts of New Orleans. Well, virtually lost in the roar and destruction of Hurricane Katrina, an important speech was delivered yesterday by President Bush to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the end of the World War II conflict with Japan. VJ Day was actually 2 weeks ago, August 14th to be exact. But never mind, the president used his speech yesterday to wrap the Iraq War and the broader war on terror more tightly than ever in the mantle of World War II.
60 years ago this Friday, General Douglas MacArthur accepted the Japanese surrender aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. With Japan's surrender, the last of our enemies in World War II was defeated. And a world war that began for America in the Pacific came to an end in the Pacific. As we mark this anniversary, we are again a nation at war.
And the analogy goes right on. This hour on point, war support flags, an analogy is drawn. And Americans are being asked to judge. Is this the World War II of our time? You can join the conversation. Is this the right analogy? Is it honest? Is it true? Does the president honor or distort history when he invokes Japan, Germany, Hitler, and FDR in Iraq and the War on Terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Linda Feldman. She's White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So here we are. The White House website says President commemorates 60th anniversary of VJ Day, but that was almost 2 weeks ago. What's pushing the president to push so hard on this World War II theme?
Well, as you mentioned, he's not making any headway in building support for the war. The war support has been steadily declining over the past several months, and they're trying to, I think as you earlier said, they're trying to reframe the debate. Obviously, the emphasis on World War II and the steadfastness that FDR showed in fighting that war is an attempt to counter the growing analogies to Vietnam that we're hearing in public. The president is talking about this war in Iraq as a moral war, and that we have that the ruthlessness of the enemy is just as fierce as it was when we were fighting the Germans and the Japanese. Whether he will succeed, I don't know. I mean, this is, I think most Americans would, if they know anything about life during World War II in this country, they would tell you that it's just not the same. The president hasn't called for the kind of sacrifice among the public that was called for during World War II. Americans, we've had tax cuts and not tax increases. Americans are not being called upon to volunteer in any fashion. There's obviously no draft. We're really being called upon to just go about our lives as usual. And so there's a problem for this president in suddenly trying to make this feel like World War II all over again.
But he went on point by very detailed point yesterday. We're going to talk with historians this hour about exactly how those analogies stand up. Paint the picture of the setting. The president's been speaking frequently before veterans recently, Salt Lake City, of course, after Cindy Sheehan began to make such a big noise down in Crawford. And yesterday at the Naval Air Station North Island, this is near San Diego, a lot of World War II vets there.
That's right. He's been really making his pitch in front of military audiences. He wants, he always likes to speak in front of friendly audiences, and the military people and their families are still largely sympathetic to the president, Cindy Sheehan notwithstanding. This is, the White House likes to roll out coordinated message periods. And, you know, over the last couple of weeks, the message is, on Iraq, we must stay the course, and we're making progress, and we have to honor the fallen by continuing to fight and see this through to the end. But I think what, you know, with the polls the way they are, and Americans increasingly feeling like this is just not worth it and that we need to get out either immediately or after a certain period of time, this is just showing the president that he hasn't yet made the case for success, that Americans might be willing to stay with the program perhaps as long as he would like to, if there was a feeling that we were heading toward a specific goal and that there is a plan for success. But I, you know, the polls are telling us that the public isn't sold yet.
But he's pulling out all the stops on this theme. Do you know, do you have any idea, Linda, who's writing these speeches? There's clearly a lot of research and almost rhetorical strategy has gone into drawing the lines here between World War II, point by point, and the Iraq War, the War on Terror. Who's pumping this out for George W. Bush?
Well, he has a whole team of people. He's got it. You could argue that his communications effort in the White House is one of the most important things they do. They're very, very message-oriented. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name of his chief speechwriter. For the first term, it was Mike Gerson, who was so important to him that he's now been elevated to counselor. But his speech team is large, and, you know, they get a lot of input from people like Karl Rove, who's Bush's political guru. And you know that these speeches are very carefully vetted and just a sort of a central aspect of what this White House does.
We know the president's been at his Western White House or the Crawford Ranch. Of course, the White House is wherever he and his crew are. You've been with them. Does the White House feel rattled?
Well, they very rarely drop their game face. I mean, they're hard to rattle visibly, but I can't imagine that they're feeling good about things right now. And the fact that the president came back to Washington early, or is coming back today over the hurricane, shows you that there is a point at which they feel they need to be here in Washington and not doing their jobs out in Crawford.
Linda Feldman with the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, thank you so much for being with us.
Great, thank you.
We are talking this hour about the president's war analogies. What rings true? What doesn't? How's it sound to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's war analogies. The war on terror equals World War II. Iraq this week equals Japan. 9/11 equals Pearl Harbor. George W. Bush, by strong inference in his big speech yesterday, equals FDR. You can join the conversation this hour. Americans are, in effect, being asked to decide. Do they, must they, dig in as Americans did half a century ago? Do you see America today in a conflict that parallels World War II? Is that analogy an appropriate call to arms? Is it true? And does the president honor or distort history with his references to Japan, Germany, Hitler, FDR? Does this draw on the deepest wellsprings of American resolve or exploit them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are going to hear from some terrific observers and historians in this hour. First, let's hear a bit more of President Bush before a lot of World War II vets yesterday in San Diego.
Once again, war came to our shores with a surprise attack that killed thousands in cold blood. Once again, we faced determined enemies who follow a ruthless ideology that despises everything America stands for. Once again, America and our allies are waging a global campaign with forces deployed on virtually every continent. And once again, we will not rest until victory is America's and our freedom is secure.
And it's World War II all over again in George W. Bush's War on Terror. We are joined in this hour, first in the studio with me, Graham Allison, professor of government at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, author of Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Challenge, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School. Graham Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from Friday Harbor, Washington, on the beautiful Puget Sound, David Kennedy is with us, professor of history at Stanford University, author of, most recently, Over Here, The First World War and American Society. David Kennedy, many thanks to you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
You have looked at this speech, Professor Kennedy. You are an historian of this era. You see the kind of links that George Bush is making, the parallels he's drawing. Is he right? Do you buy them?
Well, no, but it's pretty transparent what the president's trying to do is to reach for some kind of legitimacy by association. He's not the first president to do so. I was reminded that Woodrow Wilson, in the early days of World War I, made a point of speaking to a convention of Civil War veterans, a handful of them who were still alive, in an effort clearly to invoke a spirit of national unity, which he was quite worried about in 1917. And it's, I think, terribly clear that George Bush is working to preempt the possible comparison of the Iraq War with the Vietnam War. So he's trying to substitute another conflict for that one.
But Graham Allison, Graham Allison, there is a rallying cry here. As David Kennedy says, he wants to muster Americans. But there's also an idea being put forward here, a description of reality through this analogy. He's asking Americans to decide to support this war, and he's saying we must, because the stakes are like World War II, the challenge is like World War II, our response must be like World War II. Legitimate?
Well, I think this is marketing. I think that's your first proposition, and it's certainly right. And there's no doubt that he's struggling to sustain support for a war that's falling like a rock. So he's looking for whatever arguments can be found. I don't think this one washes, and I don't think it will wash. I think it goes back to the earlier proposition in which he's made an effort to confuse matters, and I think deliberately to confuse matters by confounding the war against al-Qaeda, the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11, with Iraq. Now, that also is a stretch, a very large stretch.
Kind of conflation of independent
of two events. Separate items. And I think as a marketing strategy, in fact, it worked to a greater extent than I think I would have imagined. That there's a huge number of Americans. You can fool a lot of the people a lot of the time, especially if you're the president. And a large number of Americans still think Saddam had something to do with the attack on 9/11 and that's therefore the reason why we're in Iraq. That's absolutely incorrect. And I think over time, as people have a chance to reflect on it, the proposition that the war on terrorism and Iraq are the same is wearing thin. And I think now to try to wrap it in an even larger wrapper of World War II with the claims that were made just don't hold.
Let's hear just a little more from the president yesterday as he makes the case. Again, the reference point is World War II over and over and over again in the speech, maybe lashing this conflict more tightly than ever to that conflict. Here's the president outside San Diego.
As freedom advances across a troubled part of the world, it is once again opposed by fanatical adherents of a murderous ideology. And once again, the stakes are high. Now as then, our enemies have made their fight a test of American credibility and resolve. Now as then, they are trying to intimidate free people and break our will, and now as then, they will fail.
The president yesterday, David Kennedy, you described this as a rallying cry. That's understandable. Graham Allison says it's marketing. But, you know, Americans are probably going to earnestly consider the proposition the president puts forward. We can see that there is a significant challenge to the global status quo, to the United States here. I think a lot of Americans will want to work out in their own minds whether this is a credible parallel and not fail to step up. If it is, help us begin to think about that, David Kennedy.
Well, I think we've been discussing a little bit the comparison between the surprise attack at Pearl Harbor and the 9/11 attacks, and I agree with Graham Allison that analogy just simply won't hold. the attack on Pearl Harbor was by quite an identifiable adversary, and we knew his return address and where to find him. The 9/11 attacks are a completely different matter, and Iraq had nothing to do with it in the first place. But I think what interests the president and his associates more is the analogy to the reconstruction effort after World War II in Germany, and as he dwelt on yesterday, especially Japan. And again, I think the comparison between Iraq as a reconstructable society and polity and what Japan was in 1945 is another comparison that simply won't hold up. Japan was culturally and historically homogeneous society. The American occupiers left intact a major symbol of political continuity in the institution of the emperor. Japan knew that it was thoroughly and utterly defeated, and the emperor reinforced that sense, and it had no choice but to submit to the will of its occupiers. None of those factors hold in Iraq. Japan also had a history of democratic culture and practices and institutions, even through the war. Japan maintained at least the form of its democracy. And again, Iraq has very little history of that sort to work with. So the comparison between the very successful and commendable effort that the United States made to reconstruct post-war Japan and what is likely to happen or is happening today in Iraq, it seems to me, is just a comparison that doesn't work at all.
We're going to look more closely at that comparison. Of course, horror show stories continuing to coming out of Iraq. Even today, the story coming of maybe 1,000 people trampled to death in a stampede on a bridge, on a holy day in Baghdad, where there was a rumor of a suicide bomber. These are not great images. But Graham Allison, Newt Gingrich is saying we have to look at this in terms of a 50 to 70 year struggle with Islamic extremism, making the same kind of, you know, major challenge pitched at that the president is making here. Okay, the details of reconstruction may not be the same, but what about the fundamental conflict the United States finds itself in now? Is it legitimate to say we have a globe-straddling conflict that's going to take a long time and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to address, and therefore it's a fair parallel to the Great War, World War II?
Well, that's a great question, and I think I'm reminded of Mark Twain's observation that history rarely repeats itself, but it does sometimes rhyme. So there's a historian at Harvard, Ernest May, who with Neustadt wrote a wonderful book called Thinking in Time, in which they say, when you think about analogies, make two columns, similarities and differences, because things are similar in some respects and different in others. I would say in this case, the most salient differences are dominant. First, World War II was a total war. 50% of our GNP was devoted to the war. We drafted 12 million people overnight to send them into the war. Mm-hmm. We taxed citizens, not cut their taxes. In this instance, if you look at it, we're talking about a couple of percent of GNP, even if you take the total defense budget that we're related to. Secondly, war, if you look in the Webster's dictionary, is defined as armed conflict between nation states, just what David said. Mm. So in the case of World War II, we had a defined enemy that had attacked us. It did have an address. They had armies in uniforms. And when they were defeated, there was somebody who could surrender and the war could be over.
Okay, but the world turns. Time moves on. It's a different kind of enemy. Does that make it a less threatening enemy? Does it make the parallel with all-out opposition less relevant?
I would say that the fact that it would, there's in its similarity column, the fact that there's that we now, in dealing with Islamic jihadism and extremist violence, one's manage, Osama has managed a kind of a global campaign, almost like a movement, and that there are adversaries around the globe, and then it's going to take a long time, are similarities. But then we put in the middle of this Iraq, which is a sideshow. And actually a confusing sideshow, and I think the thing that gives a historian the most trouble struggling with this, if you simply said similarities and differences, war on terror and World War II, that's a more interesting question. Iraq, to wrap it in the middle of this, is to wrap in something that simply doesn't fit. In the Iraqi case, the people who are opposing Americans there, 90% of them, are people whom, if and when Americans leave, will be over. Finished. This is what we would think of as traditional national liberation terrorist activities or insurgencies. And I think that what unfortunately has happened with Iraq is that we've provided a rallying point and actually a super training camp for this 10% of the people who are part of the global war on terrorism. But by putting Iraq in the middle of this, and I think we shouldn't confuse. What the president is doing is struggling to maintain public support, citizen support, for an unpopular war, which is not washing in terms of the arguments that he's made so far. So he's stretching for arguments even further afield. But, I think by that he's doing us a disservice with respect to the global war on terrorism, where I think there is some similarities to World War II. But he's not going to, I think, be successful in trying to make Iraq look like World War II.
And yet it's sitting right in the middle of the appeal that he's making now. Graham Allison, David Kennedy, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Winthrop, Massachusetts this morning, today, Herbert Bix, professor of history at SUNY Binghamton. He's author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. Herbert Bix, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the president has drawn belatedly on VJ Day. It was August 14th. One wonders if the Cindy Sheehan surge in opposition kind of drove him to this. But he's commemorating it here a couple of weeks later. And he's drawing deeply on the example of Japan to say to Americans, we can, first, we can win this new conflict and we can rebuild. Just as we rebuilt in Japan, you are a deep historian of that country and that period. What do you make of the analogy, Herbert Bix?
Well, I think that on one side, the before I would address the analogy, I think the analogy has some interesting components that stand up for a few seconds. But before doing it, I would want to clarify the nature of the war that is being fought by the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think of Japan fighting a colonialist type war of aggression in China in the 1930s.
The Greater East Asia Prosperity, Co-Prosperity
no,
Sphere.
No, this antedated the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. A notion which only really arises in 1940.
So you're looking into Manchuria, Manchukuo, and that.
That's right, and the Marco Polo bridge fighting in North China, and then the spread of fighting, and then the place name that came to symbolize the war in China, Nanjing atrocity, and it seems to me the United States is. More akin to Imperial Japan in the way it's conducted itself in the Middle East.
Empire building? Is that what you mean? Is that fair?
Managed defense of empire. Japan was seeking to defend its vested rights and interests in China, and when it could no longer do so, when Chinese nationalism had become so radical and Japanese nationalism had become equally radical, then the stage was set for military extremists and Japanese neoconservatives, I guess. They were the counterpart to our own reformist bureaucrats to begin to say we need to restructure politics and the international order in East Asia. Now, when Japan found itself, when the army precipitated an expansion of the fighting in Manchuria, Manchukuo, beyond the Great Wall, and moved into North China, and then the government of China under Chiang Kai-shek spread the fighting southward, then very soon, by the end of the year 1937, Japan found itself in a total war situation. And the gates of hell opened up for the Japanese when they committed the war atrocities in Nanjing. And I would say that the gates of hell opened up for the Americans' military in Iraq when they perpetuated the occupation and then moved against Fallujah and destroyed, virtually turned into rubble, a city about the size of Hiroshima at the time the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs.
But now the president's saying we can and must win, we must rebuild, and we'll do it here as we did in Japan. Look what a great democracy and economic power it is today, Herbert Bix.
Yes, yes. And so we have a comparison here. Mindsets, we have ideologies that could be compared. I'd like to take a moment to do so, but let's put aside the issue of economic reconstruction of Japan. It wasn't caused by freedom, you know, coming to Japan in the abstract. I would say American wars in Asia, starting with the Korean War, created a part of a significant part of the context which enabled Japan to rapidly regain its pre-war levels of productivity.
A boom built on the back of American military action there, in part in spending on that. Herbert Bix, David Kennedy, Graham Allison, please stand by. We are talking this hour about the president's war analogies. The war on terror equals World War II. What do you think, Greatest Generation listeners? Is this World War II all over again or something else? And is democracy the answer again, this time against terrorism or Islamic extremism, as it was against 20th century fascism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's war analogies made again in a big speech yesterday in San Diego, the war on terror as World War II, Iraq as Japan, 9/11 as Pearl Harbor, George W. Bush, well, frequent references to the work then of FDR. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by historian David Kennedy, author most recently of Over Here, The First World War in American Society. Herbert Bix is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Hirohito and the Making of Modern Japan. Graham Allison from Harvard's Kennedy School is with us, author of Nuclear Terrorism. Let's hear just a bit more of President Bush on the stump yesterday.
Today we must not forget the lessons of the past. And the lesson of this experience is clear. The most powerful weapon in the arsenal of democracy is the spirit of liberty. In the 20th century, the spirit of liberty worked to spread freedom from Japan and Germany to Eastern Europe, in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, and Africa. And the spirit of liberty is at work today. Across the broader Middle East, we can see freedom's power to transform nations and deliver hope to people who have not known it.
The president yesterday in San Diego. Let's take a call. Ruth is calling from Potsdam, New York. Hi, Ruth, you're on the air.
Hello. I am sitting here seething to the point where I cannot believe that this man is facing a group of World War II veterans. And they are listening. He must have collected them from the Alzheimer wards. I am solid. I was leaving college in 1943. My husband had already left for the Pacific. Mm. And the idea that this callow kid who pretends to be a leader is speaking to our country like this, well, I'm not doing very well. We might as well be listening to Donald Duck.
But Ruth, may I ask, how old are you now?
84.
And when you hear the president say, we've got a problem, it's on the scale of World War II, and we have to rise with that kind of fervor to it, doesn't that it gets no response from you, nothing?
Certainly. What he's asking us to rise to is the disaster that he created in Iraq. He is not responding to anything like what my generation took hold of, took care of, and survived. I cannot believe that this country will stand to listen to a person like George W. Bush hashing up and ruining the reputations.
Ruth, did your husband come home safe from that war from the Pacific?
He spent 2.5 years in the Pacific. He did return. But there were so many who didn't. And I can't... This president is dishonoring both the survivors and the victims the servicemen who went and didn't come back.
Ruth, we hear you loud and clear, and we're grateful for your call today. Thank you for joining us. David Kennedy, Ruth is provoked by what she's hearing. I think you were provoked by reading the president's speech yesterday. As an historian, what got your goat most here?
Well, it's the kind of shameless expropriation of the good war, World War II, as a way to wrap this war in something more palatable than he's been able to provide so far. I thought it was particularly shameless, actually, that the president began by talking about American credibility. And if you draw out the analogy, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt spent years carefully, painstakingly educating the American public from at least 1937 forward about what exactly was at stake in the conflict that we came to know as World War II and why the United States had to have a relationship to it and eventually enter it and so on. And the comparison with the record of the Bush administration's run up to the Iraq War is just points in just the opposite direction, where we were told all kinds of reasons that turned out not to be accurate for taking a role in this particular conflict or initiating this conflict. So there is something pretty bold, not to say shameless, about the president's effort to link these two conflicts and all of their moral resonance and aura to one another, just as Ruth says.
But Graham Allison, as you say, this is not, we don't have an identifiable nation as an opponent. You don't have Hirohito and the armies of Japan, Hitler and the armies of Nazi Germany. It's more subtle. It's less visible. Maybe this is the process of education that's comparable to FDR's long conversation with the nation that that David Kennedy describes. Maybe that's what we're in the midst of live here.
Well, it's conceivable, but I found Ruth's observations very poignant and hard to add to. I think if we make the kind of the May Neustadt list of similarities and differences, there's no question that with respect to the war on terrorism, there's a similarity in the sense that the people who did attack us on 9/11 and the Al-Qaeda group and its affiliates around the world are going to be a long-term problem for the U.S. and the world. So I think that I would say that's correct. But I think the proposition, if this is education, about 90% of it are things that just don't wash. And I think it's mainly about, unfortunately, wrapping us around Iraq, which is not the war on terrorism. This is a separate sideshow, as Ruth said, absolutely. And I think actually distracting us from and worsening the problem that we started with, which is that there are a huge number of people out there in the thousands who do want to kill us, as they did on 9/11. These are not Iraqis. These are the people like Osama bin Laden and al-Zarqawi, his number two. And Donald Rumsfeld actually, early on in this, asked a very good question. Here was a question he asked to his six closest associates. He said, quote, "Are we capturing, killing, or deterring and dissuading more terrorists every day than the madrasas and radical clerics are recruiting, training, and deploying against us?"
Bottom line,
he was offering this as a metric. Mm-hmm. Today, there are more such people as a result of our activities in Iraq than there were before. So I would say that that this education is actually confusing more than it's clarifying. Mm-hmm.
Important to get the framing right. Let's take a call. Stephen is calling from Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You bet.
I basically think that, let's just put Bush aside for a second. What this really is about is the culture in the Middle East. And the question that I would put to you and to your guests and to your listeners is, if you consider yourself a liberal, do you believe that everyone is entitled to basic human rights? Do you believe that women should be allowed to vote and drive? Do you believe anti-Semitism is wrong? You know, these are all big questions, just like they were dealing with in World War II. And it always strikes me as strange that people who consider themselves liberal and progressive don't extend their ideals beyond the Mediterranean. Why is the culture in the Middle East acceptable? That's the question I pose to you.
And let me ask you before we pick it up, Stephen, do you think the president's right? Can we, should we, are we obligated as a democratic country to introduce democracy and freedoms to the Middle East? Is that the solution there?
Well, I wish that Iraq had gone differently, but I think that someone has to do something, you know, the Middle East has been going backwards and getting worse and worse. And before, they were just ruining their own lives. Now they're exporting it to us and to the West. And there's nothing, you know, you can't reason with people who are oil barons and dictators. They can't be reasoned with.
So your only hope is with the people. Let us pick that up, Stephen. Thanks for your call. Herbert Bix?
Yeah, let me go back, if I will, a moment, because neither the word empire nor imperialism nor thought control have entered into our discussion, but I think we should bring them in. There's no question, all the commentators have referenced it, that Bush is trying to invest this sordid war of aggression in Iraq with the aura of World War II, where American idealism was rightly mobilized.
But why is it not rightly mobilized this time? Pick up Stephen's question.
Well,
if Bush is right, he said many times yesterday, democracy was the tonic then, it will be the tonic now, the spirit of liberty, freedom, democracy.
Yes, well, I think that in the case of Japan, we didn't go to war with Japan to spread democracy. That came a little later. The enemy was Japanese imperialism and Japan's bid for control of the oil resources of Southeast Asia.
But we ended up with democracy introduced to Japan. It did make a good long-term ally.
Well, that was a precondition for ending the occupation, a subordinate relationship, security relationship to the United States. Japanese did not want that military relationship with the United States, but they did gain a lot from it. The Bush people came into office nearly 5 years ago, many Japanese are asking, shouldn't we re-examine the negative side of the ledger?
But it's still a peaceful nation. It's still a strong economy. It's still a democracy. Even if they didn't want it, they got it, and it took root.
They did.
Why not the same path in the Middle East, as Stephen says?
Yes, they did want it, and it took root because they wanted it. Their constitution inscribes pacifism in the preface and in Article 9. And after that was made, American political elites have worked unremittingly to get the Japanese to revise Article 9. And in the new, in the era of this new American militarism and imperialism, the prime minister who came to power, I think, about the same time as George Bush, Koizumi Junichiro,
yes.
He is using the new configuration of international power to force a revision of the Constitution that will enable Japan to
rearm.
Well, it's rearmed. It has a strong military.
Right, more aggressively,
no
I guess.
Real objective threat of invasion from any neighbor, but the conservative LDP and the Japanese one-party state do wish to have the relationship revised so that they could, in the future, wage war.
And so history turns. I want to get another caller here, if I may. Brian is calling from Rockville, Maryland. Brian, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to say I take very great exception to President Bush's analogy on different levels. One is a historical and intellectual level, and the second is an emotional and personal level.
Mm-hmm.
On the first level, and this is really reiterates what some of the guests have already said, you know, Iraq and Saddam Hussein, prior to our invasion, were essentially, they were not involved with 9/11. They were not involved with al-Qaeda. And they did not have, as we've learned, weapons of mass destruction.
So you reject those factual premises. What about the emotional level? This is a deep well.
Yeah, and then I'd also like to say, as one of your guests also said, Islamic extremism is a real threat. I'm not pretending that it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, had essentially nothing to do with Islamic extremism. People like bin Laden looked upon, or still look upon, Hussein as an apostate.
He was determined secularist. Take us to the emotional side, Brian.
And on the emotional side, I'd just like to say both of my grandfathers served during World War II. One of them served in the military in the Pacific, was away for 4 years. My other grandfather, who was too old to serve, was a dollar-a-year man in Washington, D.C. And I'd also like to say my father-in-law served in Vietnam, and, you know, he was away.
So are they honored by this comparison, by this analogy, or not?
And, well, both my grandfathers are dead, so I can't speak for them, but I think they would be very much dishonored. I know my father-in-law sees analogies to Vietnam and a lot, and the disinformation or...
A very different war there. Brian, thanks for your call. I want to get one more quote from the president here. Here he's describing the grandson of two World War II Iwo Jima vets who is now in Iraq, Captain Randy Stone.
Captain Stone is a Marine officer now serving in Iraq. He knows that he and his generation are doing the same vital work in this war on terror that his grandparents did in World War II. He also knows how this struggle will end. Randy says, I know we will win because I see it in the eyes of the Marines every morning. In their eyes is the sparkle of victory.
And there, the bright and shining line drawn by George Bush between World War II and Iraq and the War on Terror, all bundled up again. David Kennedy, talk about the emotional link. He's actually drawing a kind of a family ties down through the generations, making this a matter of blood obligation to forebears.
Well, that's right. And I think it just goes to the same point that several people have touched on, that the Greeks had a name for this kind of thing. They called it hubris. It's the belief that we as mortals have the power of the gods and can rearrange the world according to our will. And I think this is where the comparison with World War II is so dangerous and delusory, because that was a moment in history when the United States had very considerable power to remake the nature of the international order and the main contours of our foreign policy, the behavior of other states. For all our power today, it may be well beyond our capacity to fundamentally change the character of Iraq, of the Middle East, and of that larger region, but the more we dwell on the comparison with World War II, the more we're in danger of falling into the trap of thinking that we can do anything.
Graham Allison, here we are. We've just got a minute left. Americans do... Professor Bix, yes, quickly,
may
please?
May I say something here about the analogy with World War II? We don't... if this egregious speech by Bush... does anything, it should make us rethink the notion of World War II as the good war. Where Japan and the United States were concerned, both were empires, imperialist powers trying to expand into the same parts of the world. And
we've got your view. That's going to be a hard one to sell, given how that towers is the good war, and we understand that. But Graham Allison, let me put to you, Americans have to decide.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's
I don't deny any of it, and we hear you, but our time is so short, I want to get a final word, if I may, from Professor Allison.
I would say that, picking up where he left off, that I think you've done a great service in calling attention to the speech. I think people should read the speech for themselves. And the question I would ask is, what's the most incredible claim in it that you can find? Now, there are a lot of candidates for that, but mine is the claim that he says, quote, a member of Japan's surrendering delegation said, we were not beaten on the battlefield by dint of superior arms. We were defeated in a spiritual conflict by a nobler idea. I think that idea was an atomic bomb.
Boom. That was pretty decisive. And there's the field. Graham Allison with Harvard's Kennedy School, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Herbert Bix, Professor of History, SUNY Binghamton, thanks for being with us. And David Kennedy of Stanford University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.